Live from New York City, it's the Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel, broadcasting but not video streaming from our studios in New York City throughout the world, and I welcome you. Today, the latest on healing all forms of conditions, including what they found out about the flu vaccine and why you might want to consider doing a little more homework before you accept that it's good for you. You know those antibiotics they give you for strep throat? Well, they're completely worthless in most cases, and I'll explain that. Been eating fish from Japan? Well, you might want to try looking at the so-called safe levels of radiation, 258 times the safe level. That's a lot of bad there. Work stress increase your heart rate, heart attack risk by 23%. Lots on health. Then we're going to take a look from our environmental segment today, a commentary from Professor Vandana Shiva on the food on Global Casino. And I want to explain that historically I've asked repeatedly that we should have a ban on all commodities essential to life. That would mean water, oil, and food, so that people could not then exploit that and have others who had no capacity to defend for themselves go hungry. You won't want to miss that. Also, I've been mentioning all along that watch China, because sooner or later, and now it's sooner, China was going to give up on using the dollar as a reserve currency. No one seemed to care. They should. They started last Thursday. According to the Examiner and Kenneth Shorkin, dollar no longer primary oil currency as China begins to sell oil using yuan. Also, Bill Clinton and some other rich white guys had a summit and agreed, it's your fault. Really? All right, what's our fault? I'll explain. Also today, I want to try to put in proper perspective, at least from my perspective, why the mainstream media, the talking heads, the White House and the Republicans all have it wrong when it comes to the violence we're seeing. I'm going to share a little more scholarly, historically accurate, and objective sense of how did we get here. I'll be sharing my insights, global research, and Benjamin Sheet, S-H-S-C-H-E-T-T, on the U.S. What have we done? I'll show you, I'll explain how we, the United States, have been using and supporting Islamic fundamentalism, and which became the roots of the U.S. Wahhabi Alliance. And these are the people who are really angry, but there are other people angry for different reasons. I'll get to that. Also, Obama's attorneys are asking the court to restore indefinite detention power after Chris Hedges and the Nation Institute won in having the lawyer, judge, the U.S. District Judge Catherine Forrest, who was an Obama appointee, she said the law is unconstitutional. Well, now they're going back and saying, no, it's not. We want the right of indefinite detention. Okay. If you say so. But I think we have to look at this very carefully and ask ourselves, why would anyone want to have that power of indefinite detention? Why? And loss of habeas corpus. We'll explain. Let's begin. Vitamin D is good for a lot of things. Helps prevent brittle bones. Helps prevent cancer. Helps prevent heart disease. Builds up your immune system. The latest study from Queen Mary University, published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, showed that tuberculosis patients who received the highest doses of vitamin D were able to have substantial reduction in their inflammatory markers. They fell further, faster, in patients receiving vitamin D. So that's good news. Now, considering that there are different strains of tuberculosis around the world, and worldwide about almost 9 million people are infected, mainly in congregations of very poor people. A lot of the refugee camps in Africa, or displaced people because of a natural disaster. Tuberculosis is not a disease of the past, and we have to remember that. It killed almost 1.5 million people last year. So it's present. So good news, vitamin D makes a difference. Now, a lot of people get strep. And if you were to stop 100 people on the streets of New York City at random and take a swab out of their throat, I'm willing to bet that the vast majority have strep present. But that does not mean that they will necessarily ever get strep throat. Generally, it happens after we've had a very stressful time, trauma, some chronic condition that depreciates our immune system. Then we get it. Most people rush out to get an antibiotic. Here's the latest on this, and it's worth focusing some attention. Quote, the antibiotics change health and medicine over the last 70 years, but when doctors prescribe antibiotics, it is based on the belief that there are no long-term effects. We've seen evidence that suggests antibiotics may permanently change the beneficial bacteria we're carrying. End quote. That's from University Langen Medical Center Dr. Martin Blaser. In this study, they found that 70% of the people taking antibiotics for strep throat, it was worthless. Let me quote this. Millions of Americans visit their doctors and receive antibiotics for a sore throat every year. According to Infectious Disease Society of America, 70% of people receive antibiotics. Antibiotics, however, do not target viruses, which cause the majority of sore throats. What we're finding is that antibiotics for strep throat are worthless. And so there you have it. Worthless, and so why take it? Because when you take an antibiotic, you're also destroying the good bacteria throughout your body, allowing even more infections to manifest. There was a report in the journal Nature that revealed that antibiotics could be to blame for skyrocketing mental illness rates due to the depletion of beneficial bacteria in the body. And antibiotics for strep throat or any other condition can also lead to obesity, diabetes, metabolic disease, and sudden death. So just be aware, the overuse of antibiotics, not good. I don't tell people whether to vaccinate or not. I just believe that we do not and have never had an honest dialogue on the benefits versus the risks of taking vaccines, nor we've had an open and honest discussion on, is there good science to prove vaccines work? On Friday, I interviewed at length two immunologists for a new film. Plus, I might mention, I also interviewed for 3 hours Dr. Andrew Wakefield, and I'll bring you the latest on his story. And Wakefield's associate, who was also challenged and had his license revoked, same time Wakefield did, appealed, went before the British Medical Commission, and got full restoration of all of his rights and was shown to be completely innocent. Wakefield did not have the funds to do that. As a result, he is now in the process of finding the funds, and hopefully he will find enough to do his appeal. And there's no reason to believe, since they were both charged with the same malfeasance, that they'll both be found completely innocent. I absolutely am certain of it, because our investigation showed he was completely innocent of all charges against him. That'll be interesting when his license is reinstated. It's not if, it's when. And then the case against all the people that slandered him, including Brian Deer and Anderson Cooper, Dr. Gupta, and others. Anyhow, one of the things that I asked him, I said, knowing you know what you know now, after what you've been through, would you still recommend vaccines? And he said, Gary, I vaccinated two of my three children and thinking, as everyone else did, that there must be an enormous amount of good science supporting the efficacy and safety of vaccines. Today, I absolutely would not, because I've had a chance. I've been forced to do what I should have done, and that is look for the actual evidence, and it's simply not there. Anyhow, more on that when I play the audio part of that on an upcoming program. It's such a long interview that I'll play it in sections. Here's the latest on vaccines. This is from Helen Branswell from the Canadian Press, Vancouver Sun. So this is mainstream news in Canada, zero in the United States. Quote, a strange vaccine-related phenomena spotted in Canada at the start of 2009 flu pandemic may have been real, a new study suggests. Researchers led by Vancouver's Dr. Deutu Skoronski, an expert in influenza at the British Columbia Center for Disease Control, noticed in the early weeks of the pandemic that people who got the flu vaccine for the 2008-09 winter season were more likely to get infected with a pandemic virus than people who hadn't received the flu shot. Five separate studies done in several provinces showed the same unsettling results. So what they're saying is that the flu shot is linked to the H1N1 illness. How about that? And that's what we were saying. In fact, if you want to read up on that, 19 articles were written by Richard Gale and myself on the fraud of the flu vaccine. And those are up on our website. They're there for you to take a look at. Also, we have updated all of the information now on why organic is safer and is more nutrient concentrated than traditionally grown produce. We also show you the campaign, the PR campaign, by Cargill and the major biotech companies to convince you otherwise. But it's just pure PR. But they are getting their message out. Our message will start this week because I will not be able to have a full 1.5 hour finished documentary, which is ideally what I'd like. We're going to be releasing over the internet free the documentary in sections on genetic engineering. And instead of simply saying why we should label it, I'm showing why it should be banned. I'm showing why it's corrupt, who's involved. Every president since George Bush Sr. has been supportive of genetic engineering, and they're all getting money. Their campaigns, and I show you the money trail, I show you the bad science. I filmed in France, England, Italy, Canada, throughout the United States, the world's leading authorities in India also, on genetic engineering. This is a real hard-hitting expose. So this will go up this week. I'll let you know when it goes up. The latest on fish out of Japan. This is from Lisa Gardner, Natural Society. It says, the mainstream media is finished with Fukushima. But it seems Fukushima isn't finished with you. Quote, a couple of irradiated fish captured near the inoperative nuclear plant showed 25,800 becquerels of cesium per kilogram. That's 258 times level determined safe by the government. The plant ceased operations following a meltdown involving three reactors after the devastating earthquake and tsunami, March 2011. Since June, officials have allowed fishing outside a 31-mile radius from the plant while being purportedly stunned by the record radiation levels of the fish. Until the recently captured pair of green lines, record radiation levels have been at about 18,000 per kilo, as found in cherry salmon. The Tokyo Electric Power Company is intent on capturing more of the fish and to explain how this is the case. Well, here's my question. What physics textbook are the scientists at Tokyo Electric Power working from? they're about as dumb as almost everyone working in the city of New York when it comes to justifying a 10-mile safety zone around Indian Point. You talk about dumb to the bone. Let's just say that there's an accident at Indian Point, and you live 11 miles away, and you're told not to worry. It's only in the 10-mile zone that you have to evacuate. So you wake up and you say, well, the authorities told us we didn't have to move, that we're safe. All right. You mean there's a law of physics that says that the air stops bringing radiation, the wind stops blowing at 10 miles? There's just kind of an invisible wall? Now, when you think about that, it doesn't take a whole lot of common sense to figure out that there are 20 million of us who live within 50 miles of Indian Point who would be affected within 4.5 hours. Where are you going to go in 4.5 hours? And then how many people could actually evacuate? And why a 10-mile zone? Well, simple. Because if there's an accident, there's no way to get people out. You see what it's like on a Friday evening at rush hour on a holiday where about 2% of the population are driving out of the city, and that's bumper to bumper. Now imagine panic. Imagine where society no longer has the normal standards. How many police are going to stay in direct traffic knowing that their family and their own health is at risk because they don't have protection from the radiation? Imagine what people would do. Most people don't top off their gas tank, so they'd be going as far as the gas in their car. Most people, in a panic, are going to make mistakes. You're going to have breakdowns. What happens if there's a breakdown in a tunnel, on a bridge, two or three on a highway? Then everything becomes a parking lot. The trouble is the radiation doesn't stop. At 12.5 miles per hour, the wind blows on average. Within 5 hours, everyone in Pennsylvania, downwind, will be exposed in New York and New Jersey. Now, it depends upon how severe a leak is, and if it's a full-scale leak, and your house can't go anywhere, and until that leak is fixed, you're going to be exposed to radiation, just like the people at Chernobyl. 1 million people died because of Chernobyl. So when it comes to this safety zone, my suggestion is buy a bike, a fold-up collapsible bike, have a knapsack, and have in it those things you need. Just put it in your closet and forget that it's there. If you need it, you put on your back and you drive, because you won't be limited by a traffic jam. And you can pedal far enough to get out of harm's way. If you live on Long Island, get yourself a small aluminum boat and back up gasoline. There's an accident, serious accident, and you got to evacuate. Just go to the boat, get your backup fuel and a small dinghy behind it, get your supplies, and go down the south coast. Just stay within eyesight, and you'll be able to refuel all the way down. There's a lot we can do, but what we're not doing is ever being honest with the people. You've not heard the governor of New York nor the mayor of New York be honest and tell people the truth that there is no such thing as safe nuclear power plants. I'll be doing an expose on how bad they are on a new report of whistleblowers, of nuclear physicists working and engineers working in the plants about the cover-ups that have occurred later this week. So now, let's just say that you're a fisherman and you dutifully go 31 miles out from Fukushima and you drop your lines and your nets. A, how do you know the fish haven't swam closer to shore? B, is there some new law of physics that keeps the currents from going back out into the ocean? Is water stagnant? In other words, the water that goes 31 miles, does it go in and back and stops at 31 miles? Of course not. So why put any type of measurement? You should ban all fishing. Ah, can't do that. Then you would have to raise the alarm about how toxic fish is. Well, fish is a major part of the protein of the Japanese diet. But then what about all the aquifers that are underneath the nuclear power plant? They go up into the primary rice-growing region of Japan. Wouldn't you then have to check for the water contamination that's being used in irrigating the fields? Yes, you would. Have you done it? No, you haven't. Why not? You don't want to suddenly show that your water is contaminated and therefore the food's contaminated. So my hope is that the Japanese people finally get the idea that their government is completely, absolutely, totally, 1,000% corrupt at every level and capable of telling the truth about anything. They don't care. Oh, as if ours does, right? Oh, well, all governments are corrupt. What am I talking about? We all know that. Why? Well, governments are just people, yeah? And look at most of the people. Most of the people who try to get a position of power are themselves grossly greedy and insecure. Medical news today. Mainstream medicine says work stress increases your heart attack by 23%. This was done at the University College London, published in The Lancet. Quote, if you have a very stressful job and are not given the freedom to make decisions, your chances of experiencing a heart attack are 23% higher. And that's, they studied 10,000 civil servants and linked job stress to a higher rate of heart attack. Okay, well, that's their work. What about their home environment? Let me figure this out. I just got to think for a moment. Stress at work creates cortisol, epinephrine, norepinephrine, adrenaline. That imbalances your hormones. That also imbalances melatonin from the pituitary gland. That means you're in severe oxidative stress. That also contributes to metabolic syndrome, diabetes and heart disease, and cancer. At home, you're in a bad relationship, but you tolerate it. For the kids' sake. You know, how many times have we heard that? Yeah. And or because you're too old, or you don't want to start all over again. Whatever reason you use to justify staying in a toxic environment. Why don't you just, I think people should have just a little tiny, they should pay a fee and just have a portable toilet overflowing with human excrement, and they just stand in it. And as people walk by saying, why in the toilet? What else can I do? What can I do? I can't get out. Sure you can. Just flush the toilet and get out. Clean yourself off. Start over. I can't. I've gotten used to everything. The stench, the debris, I've gotten used to it. So here we have all these rationalizations to stay in a toxic situation or relationship. Are we now to believe that that doesn't cause the same hormones? Stress is stress. Hormones are going to come wherever the stress is. And therefore, what they could have said is, life that is stressful increases your risk of heart attack by at least 23%. But they only kept it at work, meaning, oh man, I'm concerned about my work environment, but home, all right, it's bad, but guess it won't kill me. Yell, it will, dude. It absolutely will. Diabetes is linked to breast cancer risk. This is from the British Journal of Cancer. And it says, having type 2 diabetes appears to give postmenopausal women a 27% higher risk of developing breast cancer. And if you're overweight, even more. They studied 56,000 breast cancer cases in four continents, the Preventative Research Institute, Lyon, France, to come up with this. My suggestion is simple. We have a way of preventing and reversing diabetes, adult diabetes. And there's no reason that we shouldn't be advocating the preventative programs nationwide. New analysis of our drinking water related gastrointestinal illness. This is from Medical News. This is mainstream medicine, as published in the Environmental Science Technology Journal. Quote, the distribution system piping the U.S. public water systems that rely on non-disinfected well water or groundwater may be largely unrecognized, cause of up to a million annual cases of acute gastrointestinal illnesses involving nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. They studied why more than 100 million people in the U.S. have water pipes that are corroded, schools, businesses, they're all getting the water from the same systems, but some are getting it from wells and others from lakes and rivers, and others from above ground sources. And much of that water either is not disinfected at all, or is not adequately disinfected to kill disease-causing viruses. All right, why don't we do this? Why don't we simply advocate people to have, wherever possible, free public water checks, and that would also give a lot of people who are highly skilled and a chance to do something good for society and get a living wage in the process, go around and start checking everyone's water and see whether or not your water is safe to drink or not. That would do a lot of good. And then why not start using ozone? Commercial ozonated filters in water systems could purify all that drinking water and is much better than chlorine and much safer. And finally, if you can afford a home filtration system, use it. Have you ever heard of soursop? It's a fruit, and it's generally from the tropical regions. I remember I had some after a marathon. I didn't know what it was. They had it on the stand, and I picked it up, and I took it back and washed it off and ate it. It has prickly green little nodules on it. I didn't know it at the time, but it can kill cancer 10,000 times more effectively than strong chemotherapy drugs with no side effects and without harming any healthy cells. I had no knowledge of that. I just was looking at it for its phytonutrient qualities. According to the Cancer Research Society, the active principle in any of these remedies can make an enormous difference, but we're not using them, and we should. There's a tree that grows in Brazil called the Graviola, Graviola. And there's one in Spain called the Guanabana, Guanabana. They are kind of a subacid, sweet white pulp. You can just eat it right out of there. Put it in a drink or a smoothie. But there's broad-spread antimicrobial benefits and antibacterial and antifungal benefits and antiviral benefits, and they're used there. I said, what do you use this for? They said, parasites, worms. But it also lowers blood pressure, helps with depression and stress, and nervous disorders. And if you went inside the Amazon rainforest, where I've been, this tree grows wild and could literally revolutionize what we do with cancer. So remember, soursop has anti-cancer benefits, protects your immune system, great for colds and flu. You're going to feel stronger. It boosts your energy, improves your outlook on life. And there's a lot of science behind it. In fact, it was able to effectively target and kill malignant cells in 12 types of cancer, including the bad, colorectal, breast, prostate, lung, and pancreatic cancers. And the tree compounds proved up to 10,000 times stronger in slowing the growth of cancer cells than adriamycin, which is a normal chemotherapy agent. So for the listeners in this audience from Jamaica, Trinidad, and South America, I'm quite sure you've heard of soursop and used it for different reasons. Just want to let you know you've got something really good there. But not to be outdone, researchers from the College of Pharmacy of Saudi Arabia's King Saud University have found that the leaves and branches of the red spruge tree, S-P-U-R-G-E, spurge tree, which is a small tree that grows in hot and tropical regions. It can grow in Mexico, the Caribbean, Africa, Hawaii. It inhibits the growth of liver cancer. they have done an analysis and found that the leaves and the branches are very powerful at killing cancers, but also extremely rich in polyphenols, including two that had never been found before. So for liver cancer, look it up. Get your doctor to use it. The red spurge tree, S-P-U-R-G-E. That's the latest on health and nutrition. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment to take on some of the important issues. And we have a newsmaker coming up, especially for the people living in New Jersey, and also really powerful progressive commentary hour tonight at 7 p.m., how to steal an election. I believe we're going to see massive voter fraud. I also don't believe, I know it's an absolute irrefutable fact, that Ohio and its voter group engaged in fraud in the election when John Kerry was running against George Bush. What would he win by? 145,000 votes, but Kerry had 135,000 ahead of Bush, and then suddenly Bush flies in at the end of the day, and suddenly it all changes in the middle of the night. How's that happen? How to steal an election? I'm going to look at the tactics of Karl Rove and the Koch brothers and the Dems and the GOP and ALEC. They all use to swing elections and ways to protect your vote or to use your vote. My guest, Greg Palast, Professor Harvey Wasserman, and I believe Robert Kennedy Jr., 7 p.m. Progressive Commentary Hour tonight. Coming up this week, we'll be talking with William Biney, National Security Officer and Whistleblower on Government Surveillance of Americans. Juan Cole, Professor of Middle East Studies and Politics, University of Michigan, The Collapse of American Foreign Policy in the Middle East. James Howard Kunstler, Sociopolitical Critic and Author of Peak Oil, Our Nation's Addiction to Too Much Wishful Thinking and Technology to Solve Crisis. And Judy Woods, whoa, she's got some really new stuff to talk about, 9/11. And also Professor Omid Safi, Professor of Islamic and Persian Iranian Studies, University of North Carolina, discuss in depth. I was going to do it myself, but I'd prefer him to do it. I wanted to hear how Mark Levin and Michael Savage and all the other neocons and warmongers were handling the trouble in the Middle East. And one of them said, oh, you know, the Shah was my friend, you know, he was a good person. No, he wasn't. So a really detailed history of everything that the Shah did, how we kept him in power, how many of his citizens, his progressives, anyone who wanted a positive outlook on life, how they were imprisoned, tortured, and killed, all with the knowledge and cooperation of our CIA and government, how a democratically elected government in Iran was overthrown, and with the backing and support of British Petroleum. So we'll give you a real answer to our problems over there, not what these people are suggesting. Have a lot to share. Stay with us. Back in a moment. Everyone, I'm Gary Nall. Our commentary today comes from Vandana Shiva from the Asian Age, and it's called Food on Global Casino. And then we'll go from here to our newsmaker, then your calls on our talkback segment. This is what Vandana Shiva has to say. Food is our nourishment. It is the source of life. Growing food, processing, and transforming and distributing it involves 70% of humanity. Eating food involves all of us. Yet it is not the culture or human rights that are shaping today's dominant food economy. Rather, speculation and profits are designing food production and distribution. Putting food on the global financial casino is a design for hunger. After the U.S. subprime crisis and the Wall Street crash, investors rushed to commodity markets, especially oil and agricultural commodities. And while real production did not increase between 2005 and 2007, commodity speculation in food increased 160%. Speculation pushed up prices, and higher prices pushed an additional 100 million people into hunger. Barclays, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan are all playing on the global food casino. A 2008 advertisement in Deutsche Bank stated, quote, "Do you enjoy rising prices? Everybody talks about the commodities. With the Agriculture Eco Fund, you can benefit from the increase in the value of the seven most important agricultural commodities," end quote. When speculation drives up prices, the rich investors get richer and the poor starve to death. The financial deregulation that destabilized the world's financial system is now destabilizing the world food system. The price rise is not just a result of supply and demand. It is predominantly a result of speculation. Between 2003 and 2008, the commodity index speculation increased from 1,900% from an estimated $13 billion to $260 billion. 30% of these index funds are invested in food commodities. As the Agricultural Accountability Initiative states, quote, "We live in a brave new world of 24-hour electronic trading, triggered by algorithms of composite price indices, fits of investor lack of confidence, and of unregulated dark pools of more than $7 trillion in over-the-counter commodities derivatives trades," end quote. The world commodity trading has no relationship to food. It is diversity to its growers or eaters, to the seasons, to sowing or harvesting. Food diversity is reduced to 8 commodities and bundled into composite price index. Seasons are replaced by 24-hour trading. Food production driven by sunshine and photosynthesis is displaced by dark pools of investment of $7 trillion. The tragedy is that this unreal world is creating hunger for real people in the real world. In the food bubble, how Wall Street starved millions and got away with it, a cover story for Harper's, Frederick Kaufman states the history of food took an ominous turn in 1991, at a time when no one was paying much attention. That was the year Goldman Sachs decided our daily bread might be an exciting investment, end quote. And the entry of investors like Goldman Sachs, AIG Commodity Index, Bear Stearns, Oppenheimer, and PIMCO, Barclays, allowed agribusiness to increase its profits. In the first quarter of 2008, Cargo attributed its 86% jump in profits to commodity trading. Conagra sold its trading arm to a hedge fund for $2.8 billion. Gambling on the price of wheat for profits took food away from 250 million people. Speculation had separated the price of food from the value of food. As Austin Damani, a wheat broker, told Fred Kaufman, quote, "We traded wheat, but it's wheat we're never going to see. It's a cerebral experience," end quote. Food is an ecological experience, a sensory experience, a biological experience. With speculation, it has been removed from its own reality. Grain markets have been transformed, with futures trading by the grain giants in Chicago, Kansas City, and Minneapolis combined with speculation by investors. And as Mr. Kaufman says, quote, "Imaginary wheat bought anywhere affects real wheat bought everywhere. So if you do not decommodify food more, and more people will be denied food. As more and more money is poured into the global casino, the artificial process of speculation is driving up prices of food and taking it beyond the reach of hundreds of millions of people. The rules of the World Trade Organization, the structural adjustment programs, the World Bank, and the International Monetary Fund and bilateral free trade agreements have forced the integration of local and national food economies into the global market. And now the global financial system is speculating on food commodities and influencing prices and the right to food of the poorest person in the remotest corner of the world. The spike in the world food prices started to reappear in 2011. According to the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN, in January 2011, the food price index was up 3.4% from December. Cereal prices were 3% above December and at the highest level since July. In India, the prices of onion jumped tremendously. And as a result, people could not afford them. So here it is. Let me put this in perspective. With all the different movements and all the different things we talk about, no one at the national level, except for the independent candidates of Jill Stein, Gary Johnson, and Rocky Anderson, no one is talking about food, our right to it, and how we shouldn't have to pay some super speculative profit price so that people who are already incredibly wealthy can be even more wealthy. We should be exposing the people who are manipulating the price of commodities to show who they are. Because how else do you deal with the fact that we have 1.1 billion people, one-seventh of the world's population, who are in hunger crisis? They're starving to death. And yet while they're starving, we have people who control the political parties, control the media, control NPR, absolutely positively control everything at PBS. It sold its soul a long time ago. Shame on it, but it has no shame. Just a bunch of yuppies from hell run it. Real dilettantes in the real world couldn't last a week. And all the while, we don't pay attention to who won't wake up tomorrow in some place in the world because they didn't have enough food. Shame on us for not making this an issue. My suggestion? Ban, make it against the law to trade in any commodity essential to life. I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to go over now and say hello to our newsmaker who is standing by to talk about something that shouldn't surprise us. Influence peddling in New Jersey politics. Boy, that never has happened, has it? There's a New Jersey state bill, 1759. Write this down if you live in New Jersey. It's an attempt to limit and then further remove religious exemption from vaccination. Here to talk about this is Ralph Fuditola. He has become known as the nation's health lawyer. He specializes in nutrient and alternative health law, and he's recognized for leading us in a way to protect our freedoms of choice. He also was responsible for having DHEA legalized. And he's also a watchdog lawyer. He investigates big pharmaceutical industries, attempts to diminish the vitamin industry. Nice to have you with us today, Ralph.
A pleasure to be with you too, Gary. Thank you so much for giving me an opportunity to tell people what's going on. And it's not just in New Jersey. There's a national move by drug pusher legislators, not just in New Jersey, but in California, in Washington State, in several other states, to change the religious exemptions and the philosophical exemptions in a very peculiar way. But to start with New Jersey, yes, it's true, the two legislators who have introduced this bad bill get a lot of money from the drug pusher companies. Well, New Jersey has a lot of drug companies in it. Perhaps that's part of the reason. Perhaps it's not. These bills, the one in California, which is sitting on Governor Brown's desk right now. So I urge Californians, you must contact your governor and tell him to say no to that bill, which I think is Assembly Bill 2109. And we want people in New Jersey to say no to the bill in New Jersey, which is 1759. What do these bills do? The same thing. They impose restrictions on freedom of speech and they impose state-sponsored speech. They say, oh, you can still have your religious exemption in New Jersey. Of course, they specifically exclude a philosophical exemption. But they say, yeah, you can still have your exemption if. And they start piling on the burdens on the free exercise of religion and on expressive association. And the biggest burden of all is you can do it if you get a letter from a doctor who or a nurse who has explained to you the benefits of vaccines and the risks to your children of not being vaccinated. Well, this is official speech. Doctors will become state-sponsored propagandists, and they will be told essentially that they must violate their most sacred oath to do no harm, because certainly they will not be telling children's parents that vaccines will cause, as a foreseeable result of the use of vaccines, will cause harm to the children. And that's what's terrible about this. We have here state-mandated speech and state-mandated learning, if you will. We have to all learn what the state wants us to. Parents must sign off saying, oh, yes, I was told that I'm a bad parent, in a sense. That's exactly what's being done here. It is a vicious attack on not just religion, but on free speech, on free association, and on the right and obligation of parents to protect their children who are at risk from state-mediated death.
Ralph, what can we do for those parents?
What we can
who
do right now is we
vaccines.
Can make sure. Yeah, we can educate our legislators to tell them, heck no, we won't let this happen. And we do that by setting up, and we've done this through Natural Solutions Foundation, we've set up an action item, that's so-called. It's a real simple online system that lets you send an email message targeted to your personal representatives in the state government, your state assemblymen
right, Ralph,
and senators.
Tell us how to reach
them. You get
them.
To it by going to one of our tiny URLs. It's tinyurl.com/stopforcedvax. V-A-X, one long word, Stop Forced Vax, and it's tinyurl.com. Of course, you can always go to our main website, healthfreedomusa.org, and right there you'll see a link to what we call our pushback section, where you can send messages to your legislators and decision makers telling them what they ought to be doing instead of listening to the drug pushers. Thank you, Gary.
Good. Give us that one more time.
Right. HealthFreedomUSA.org, or go directly to Stop Forced Vax. That's it. Stop Forced Vax.
Okay, good. Ralph, thank you. Let's all say to the people in New Jersey and the legislature, we are opposed to Senate Bill 1759. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
I'm Gary Noll. We're going to take, and that's that whole bill, I read it, is posted on my Facebook and Twitter and websites, so you can go there and read it and get into the whole thing there. We're going to take your calls now. Give us a call at 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. I'm Gary Noll, and while you're waiting, let's go over, and I just want to do this one thing. I promise I'd do this, because I see something coming. I see the dollar taking a hit, and a lot of people don't pay attention to how powerful China is when it comes to manipulating currencies. Quote from the Examiner, Kenneth Shorchin. It talks about how a former minister to the global oil companies during the building of the Alaskan pipeline announced the most significant event to affect the U.S. dollar since the inception as a currency, for the first time since 1970s when Henry Kissinger forged a trade agreement with the Royal House of Saud to sell oil using only U.S. dollars, China announced its intention to bypass the dollar for global oil customers and began selling the commodity using their own currency. Quote, this is from Lindsay Williams. The most significant day in the history of the American dollar since its inception happened last Thursday. On that day, something took place that is going to affect your life, your family, your dinner table, more than you could possibly imagine. China made the announcement official. China said last Thursday, our banking system is ready. All of our communication systems are ready. All the transfer systems are ready as of this day. Any nation in the world that wishes from this point on to buy, sell, or trade crude can do using the Chinese currency, not the American dollar, end quote. Now, I would disagree. I don't believe it's the most important thing to happen since the our current system was developed. I think the Federal Reserve creation is the worst thing to happen, the most significant thing. But it is an important announcement because China is one of the most significant sea changers in economic and monetary systems. It wasn't reported in the American media. What are the ramifications of this? This could act as a catalyst that could bring down the dollar as the global reserve currency and change the entire way that the world purchases energy. Now, keep in mind that the U.S. dollar had fallen from 81.46 on the index to today's price of 79.7 on that same day. And yet we're putting all of our energy in the eurozone and the Federal Reserve and their quantitative easing as if that's going to make a difference. It will not. But as of last Thursday, they're going to be trading. Well, who are they going to trade with? They're going to trade with Russia. And Russia has already established this. Russia announced on Friday that it will supply China with all the crude oil that they need, no matter how much they want. There's no limit, and Russia will not sell or trade this crude to China using the American dollar. So, that's the beginning. Now let's see where it goes. Let's say hello to James from Queens. Hi, James. Your turn.
Good afternoon, Mr. Gary.
Yeah.
Can I hear you?
Yeah, I can hear you fine.
Okay, Gary, there's an issue now that's happening over there in Japan, over some islands that are in the borderline between China and Japan. Now, as it stands, Japan bought these islands from China. China says that, well, it still belongs to us. So now that's causing a ripple in the economy, and now China is getting ready to send a naval fleet to sort of like preoccupy the area. And now we heard on the radio that Japanese factories in China have shut their doors to the workers due to the fact that the Chinese now don't like the Japanese. So I was wondering, can you commentate, because I think this is going to have an effect on our economy.
It will not affect our economy, and I don't see that China and Japan will go much further than the Chinese supporting. Remember, the Chinese supported this. You've had Chinese living in Japanese living in China, and you've had Japanese doing business in China for quite some time. This was mainly a reaction to the local Chinese people and their sense of nationality. So they're the ones who have trashed the offices, burned some buildings, tearing down factories, anything they can do. And the Chinese have to step in. They don't want to put themselves between the Japanese on one end and their own people on the other, because China has more spontaneous riots, over 100,000 last year, in any other country in the world. So I see this as going to blow over. I don't see this as anything substantial. It certainly won't impact us here. Okay? Thanks for your call. We have 2 minutes to go before we say goodbye to our land-based stations, our terrestrial stations. For those of you who want to continue listening, because I am going to take on some other issues, our number is 832-280-0066, 832-280-0066. That's a telephone. You can call anywhere in North America or Canada, so you're no longer locked right at in your car listening at this hour or your home or apartment. And by the way, I think, I have to confirm this, I think we're passing 60,000 people listening over the telephone, making the number one in the world listening over the telephone. Or you can continue on the internet. So let's go over now and say hello to Tom from New Jersey. Hi, Tom.
Hello, Gary. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yeah, back in February, first week of February this past year, I had a cat who adopted me. He was wild. He had rabies. So my doctor recommended that I get a rabies vaccination from the cat because even though he didn't bite me, I was taking care of him. I had this back in February. Ever since then, I'm exhausted every day. I can't sleep at night. My shoulders are aching. I've gone to 4 different doctors. No doctor will recognize the fact that I'm ill due to this vaccination. I'm They've tested every organ, every gland. But I'm saying I want to be tested for a reaction due to a vaccination here, and that's not what you're doing here.
Well,
and I don't know who to go to.
Okay, what I would suggest is you go to an immunologist. First, have him check you for the rabies titers to see what titers you have. Then have him check you to see if what your level of T-cell, red blood cells, viral counts are, to see what reaction the antibodies have had to your immune system. Then you can start to detoxify from the effects of the vaccine, which is entirely possible. But first you have to get your full blood profile, and an immunologist could do that. Okay? You should have had, by the way, before you let anyone vaccinate, you should have had you should have a blood workup to see whether or not you had any exposure and any infection. Because if you didn't, then there would have been absolutely no reason to have given you that. Okay? Thank you. Let's say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. Well, I don't know if we have much time about it, but as many people know, this is our one-year anniversary of the Occupy Wall Street movement. And we've had a couple of people send me emails to comment on what's happening. And basically, they feel that not only is there a contempt for anyone with money, but they also have this big contempt for the Tea Party. And knowing your audience the way you know your audience, they're not just looking at the one angle of the issue. What they're asking is this. They said no one is challenging this movement, no one. And what they're asking is if you can take a look at, compare the Occupy movement to the Tea Party movement, which also emerged because people were getting fed up with the status quo. What is your comment on that?
I would break them into two segments. You have to deal with them separately. First, I would suggest as far as Occupy movement. Last evening, while I was having a bite of food, I was giving myself a few hours rest. I was introduced to a person at a table in a restaurant who was one of the founders of the Occupy movement. And where normally people say hello, you know, and go on. This person wanted to get in this whole debate about my position on this. Here is my thought. I believe that the Occupy movement was a seminal moment to make people aware of the gross disparity between those who have and those who have not. That's it. That's on the positive side of the ledger. On the negative side, the lack of organization, the lack of inviting people from the African American community, the Latino community, from the women's community, who have been a part of major social struggles, to help them show how you can take a movement of inspired and motivated, mainly young people, and cause something good to come from it. And that wasn't what was allowed. In fact, when myself and others went down 28 days in a row, there was a sense of, well, this is our movement. What do you mean, your movement? This is our country. We're all part of it. And if you're looking at a way of making things better, then be specific. Because if you just say we're against something, and if it's too broad-based, then you miss the point entirely. And I believe that that's what happened. So instead of saying, let's be against the student loan, the laws that don't allow you to declare bankruptcy if you need to, the usurious rates that you're charged if you cannot pay the monthly fee after you graduate, and then you get compounding interest, the fact that the banks that are holding your student loan were given that money for free from the Federal Reserve, and frequently your mother, father, grandmother, grandfather had to sign, and now hundreds of thousands of them, senior citizens, are having their Social Security checks deducted for that amount, and they can barely afford to live. So these are all issues. So if you're young, many of you are in college, why not start a college movement? Because that's something you could all agree upon. Most people would agree, college students, college is too expensive, and it's very punitive what they can do. They can arrest you. They can put you in debtor's prison if you don't pay your bill. Focus on that, something you could agree with. Nothing happened. Focus upon the home foreclosures and how to take 100,000 students from the White House to say, Mr. President, put an executive order to stop home foreclosures, have a moratorium on home foreclosures 3 years. Never happened. Focus upon 18 million hungry children. Never happened. Homeless vets. Never happened. Nuclear radiation. Never happened. No matter what was presented, nothing happened. And I believe that part of that is because of the conditioning of many of the people. The vast majority of people, at least initially, that I interviewed, came from privileged backgrounds, where if there was a mistake, they had someone who would act as a safety net to cover them. And the sense of entitlement that if they show up because they're very special and very gifted and very blessed and almost perfect, as their parents and everyone else around them have told them consistently, that they didn't need input from people who had actually gone through struggles without safety nets and put themselves in harm's way. And a movement should not be about whether someone has a library and a tent or has enough warm blankets or has a, you know, place to go to the bathroom. It should be about getting something done beyond themselves, because otherwise it just becomes a narcissistic expression of a basic underlying contempt, but is not actualized through any self-sacrifice or real inner realizations. It just totally lacked intellectual depth and spiritual components. And yet the left embraced it as voraciously as the right embraced the Tea Party movement, without critical input, as if, oh, I can't say anything negative about them because I have to show I'm, you know, card-carrying, and that's what we had. It was an embarrassment, especially at non-commercial BAI and the embrace of that. So at the end, a year went by and nothing's happened. So we have this supercilious notion of 1%, 99%. What exactly does that mean? What exactly? It means nothing. Because not everyone who is wealthy is evil or greedy. It also means that many people who are poor are just as selfish, if they had the opportunity to be, and just as anti-social as someone who chooses to be, who can afford to be. And I simply look at the figures. Look at the amount of obesity. Look at the amount of abuse within families, children's abuse. Look at the amount of rape. Look at the amount of violence one-on-one within family settings. Look at the number of people who try to cheat any system for their own advantage. Look at the people who will not take on any responsibility for helping make it a better world. They won't stop polluting. They will shop in the box stores and use some rationalization. Well, they're poor, so they have to. No, you became poor because you didn't stand up and fight and have other unions fight, and they have already sold their soul to get a place at the Democratic Convention. And so everywhere you look, you see that the 99% is substantially sullied itself, and no one wanted to acknowledge it. And so when you ask, well, friends, where are the demonstrations of the 99% to stop using their banks, the 1% banks? When is the 99% going to stop using their McDonald's and their Coca-Cola and their Fox television and their reality shows that are just debauchery? When is the 99% going to stop going to their Disneyland and their theme parks and their movies? When is 99% going to stop eating their food genetically engineered? If you don't have the capacity to separate these issues, to see the kind of nonsense that occurs, the intellectual deception that occurs when we think, oh, 99% the angels sleep with, 1% the devil sleeps with, then you don't realize nothing will happen because of that. And it's only when you be specific. Now, when Chris Hedges and about 1,300 of these listeners from this audience, we met down in Union Square, it was specific. Cross the street is the Bank of America. Tear up your credit cards, form a human chain around it, take out no more loans, have nothing more to do with it, and let the public know this is a bad bank, a bad corporation. Hand out literature why it's bad. Show people what's wrong with this specific bank. And it made an impact. You must be focused. You must have a single story. You must galvanize. You must do your homework. You must provide tools for social change if you're going to have social change. So just about everything you could do wrong was done wrong. It only became about them and not about all of us. when you exclude people from an effort because they don't align with you in age or a social status, then what exactly are you doing to make it a better world? So it's one of these faux movements. On the other hand, when I heard the Democrats and Keith Olbermann and Rachel Maddow just slamming as racist and bigoted and bigoted the Tea Party, I just decided to go and see. So I went to many Tea Party movements. I spent a whole day down in Philadelphia at one of their largest ones. I interviewed probably 300 people all told. And as you see from photographs or up on my website, a lot of them were African Americans and Latinos. Most of those people were against the wars, against the Federal Reserve, against the way our tax money is spent, against bloated bureaucracies, and against people trying to tell us how to live our lives. I absolutely concur with all that. Now, I'm opposed to many of their positions on other issues, but to sweep them all out the door, to say they have nothing of value, to say that they are all, redneck idiots, was demeaning to a process of openness and inclusion, to sit and talk with someone and at least hold your thoughts until you see the completeness of a person's position. And that was not done. So the right dumped on the Occupy movement, and the left dumped upon the Tea Party. I believe they were both wrong to do so. In our society, we should have room for people to protest, and we can agree or disagree with what they're protesting. We shouldn't be demeaning a person's right to protest and look at each issue to see whether or not you agree or disagree with how they're protesting, what is likely to come from it, and then take it from there. Hope that answers your question. Sorry,
absolutely.
We've run over into Utrice Leed's time, so I'm going to say goodbye and welcome Utrice Leed, a very important voice to Progressive Radio Network, Monday to Friday following my show. She's up next. Please stay with us.